So what I want to do today, and I think that's probably going to cover the morning and the afternoon lecture, is to talk about hypersurfaces. So we're still in the middle of that section. But I want to talk about something very, very specific about hypersurfaces, something called extrinsic curvature. I think one of the most important concepts of differential geometry, something that is used all over the place when you do GR, and I've explained some of the context behind the use of hypersurfaces in GR in the previous lectures, but I'll come back to some of those aspects as we keep talking about this. So extrinsic curvature is a concept that goes back to the earliest work on differential geometry, tracing back to Gauss, and it's been sort of formalized more mathematically in subsequent developments, but that's something that's really central to the differential geometry of hypersurfaces. So in the context of Gauss, it was, in an effort to describe the geometry of two surfaces in three-dimensional space, and now we go one dimension higher. So we're talking about the extrinsic geometry of hypersurfaces in an underlying four-dimensional space-time. So I'll explain what this is all about in just a second, but before we get to that, I'll say one thing and then I'll remind you of the Gaussian coordinates. So extrinsic curvature is a topic that's so important that I had to include it in those lectures, so that's why I'm talking about it today. That's something that I guarantee you will encounter in a lot of the literature on general relativity or, gravitation theory in general. But that's not something that we're going to use in our description of black holes. So when we move to black holes, that's not something that I'll need for those lectures. So because of that, I'm going to be perhaps a bit more sketchy in my derivations here. I won't prove everything. I won't, go through as much detail as perhaps I did for the other parts of the lecture of the course. And I'll leave some of the stuff for you to work out on your own with the help of the post-it notes that will contain more details. Okay, so that's what we want to talk about. And the Gaussian coordinates that I introduced in previous lectures, that's going to play a pretty central role in at least the lecture this morning. So just remind you of what that is. So we're using Gaussian coordinates to provide the simplest description of space-time around a hypersurface, and the idea is to make use of the coordinates that we give ourselves on that surface, but try to extend them a little bit above, a little bit below, in a way that we can describe the entire space-time metric around the hypersurface. So the idea is that through each point on the hypersurface, we're going to launch a geodesic that's going to be orthogonal to the hypersurface. And L is going to be either proper time on that geodesic or proper distance counted from the point of intersection. So the point of intersection is going to be zero. And if we go above the surface, it's going to go negative. If we go below, it's going to be negative. So that's the first part of the construction. And then the second part of the construction is to make sure that those geodesics actually carry with them the value of the coordinates that corresponds to the intersection point. Okay, so that keeps happening. So people show up late in class. I'm always on time. I expect you to be on time too. I consider it to be a lack of respect not to show up on time. So please make a note of this. All right, so the other part of the construction is that the geodesics carry with them the value of the coordinates from where they originate, so that the coordinates that are initially defined purely on the hypersurface are extended away from the hypersurface like this in an orthogonal fashion. So that means that when we actually write down the metric for a neighborhood of that hypersurface, well, we're going to have a term like this that corresponds to orthogonal displacements. We're going to have terms like this that correspond essentially to tangential displacements. And the fact that we have no mixture between dl and dy, that's something that comes out because of the orthogonality of the geodesics. So that geometric construction that I described is what provides for us a nice diagonal form for the metric, at least when we mix together the l direction and the YA direction. We have an induced metric on the hypersurface, and that induced metric will agree with the underlying spatial components of the metric, so to speak, when L is equal to zero. So we get to the induced metric by just taking the generalized version of that and evaluating that at L equals zero. And, you know, I have an epsilon parameter here that tells me whether my hypersurface is space-like or time-like. So if it's space-like, the normal direction is time-like, and that means that the normal vector is going to be of negative norm. And in that case, that means that L is actually a proper time quantity. And then the opposite is true if the hypersurface is time-like. Okay, so we're going to make a lot of use of this in today's lecture. Okay, so what do I mean by extrinsic curvature? Well, maybe I should start by saying what I mean by intrinsic geometry. So it's extrinsic versus intrinsic geometry. So let's begin with intrinsic geometry of a hypersurface sigma. And what I mean by that is basically all the geometry that I can do if I work purely on the hypersurface. So imagine myself to be, a being that is only aware of the hypersurface, is never allowed to make measurements away from the hypersurface, and is therefore restricted to all the metric information that is purely intrinsic to the hypersurface, and that's provided by the induced metric. So that's all the geometry that is provided to us by the induced metric. And the induced metric gives us, well, quite a lot of things. It gives us a derivative operator that's going to be a covariant derivative compatible with that induced metric. And together we can get a notion of a Riemann tensor that is purely three-dimensional and purely intrinsic to the hypersurface. And from that, we can go deeper and form Ricci tensors and Ricci scalars and things like that. And basically, all of those things are defined entirely in terms of the induced metric, and therefore completely intrinsic to the hypersurface itself. So it gives us information purely about the intrinsic geometry of the hypersurface. When I talk about the intrinsic geometry is when we allow ourselves to go a little bit, above or below the surface and start asking about, for example, how the surface bends in the underlying spacetime. So the intrinsic geometry doesn't tell us anything about this. It ignores completely what happens on the outside. And here I really want to take that into consideration. So that's what I mean by the extrinsic geometry. And that's really asking how the surface bends. And that brings out information that is not available if you think purely in terms of the intrinsic aspects of the hypersurface. And that's something that, well, will be measured in terms of a quantity KAB that I'll call the extrinsic curvature. And I'll define that to be the quantity that describes that bending of the surface in the spacetime. So that's the extrinsic curvature. And first I'll introduce it in terms of sort of rough ideas, what it represents, what do I mean by bending and so forth. And then we'll introduce it more formally. First I'll introduce it through the Gaussian coordinates because they're really well suited to that discussion. And then I'll come up with a definition that is purely covariant that allows you to calculate it without having to construct Gaussian coordinates in practice, which would be, typically difficult. So Gaussian coordinates are great in terms of conceptual considerations, but if you're asked to construct them explicitly and relate them to some other favorite coordinate system for a given spacetime, that can be fairly difficult to do. So that's why it's important to go away eventually from Gaussian coordinates and give that a completely covariant definition. So we'll get there. Okay, so what do I mean by bending? Well, here I'm going to think of just a two-dimensional surface in three-dimensional space. That's going to be easier to draw on the board. And but the ideas apply just the same if we talk about hypersurfaces in four-dimensional spacetimes. And the idea would be to, you know, compare a situation like this where I have a surface that is actually concave, if I'm looking at it from the top here, versus a surface that would be convex. So very different ways of bending, and we want to capture that mathematically with some key ideas that I'm about to describe. So we're going to be contrasting here a concave surface versus a convex surface. And of course, if I flip and I exchange the identity of up and down, I turn one into another. So the important point here is that we're looking at this from the point of view of somebody who's above the surface, and we're looking at the bending from that point of view. All right, so here's the key idea, and here's the key idea that's supposed to be captured by the extrinsic curvature. So I know about the metric on that hypersurface. So we're given an induced metric on that hypersurface. And what I want to do here is to, you know, compare it to what it would be a little bit above that surface. So what I'm going to do here is to, I'm going to pick a point here. I'm going to pick, you know, a whole bunch of points like this. And, you know, in principle, I'm doing this in a continuous way. And I'm going to do, in the spirit of Gaussian coordinates, I'm going to launch geodesics orthogonal to the surface at those points. So here's one. So here my surface is embedded in flat space, so my geodesics are nice straight lines. So I just launch a whole bunch of them. And what I'm going to do next is to go some distance away from the surface, let's say delta L equals 1. And then I'm going to draw a new surface that's going to be the translated version of that first surface. So here I'm just picking a delta L, and it's going to be a fixed quantity. And then I'm going to draw a new surface, you know, corresponding to that fixed delta L distance above the first one. And then I'm going to get a new collection of points. And what I want to compare is the distance between those two points versus the distance between those two points. And I think the diagram makes it pretty clear that as we go up like this, the distance is shrinking a little bit, because those geodesics here, those straight lines, are converging together. So the distance that we get here is going to be a bit shorter than the distance here. And that's going to be true for all of those points if we're dealing with a concave surface. The extrinsic curvature means to capture that notion that the distances have shrunk as we go above the surface. So here I want to say that distances have gone down. And if distances have gone down, well, that's an indication that the metric, in some sense, has decreased as well as we move up in the normal direction. So, you know, in just a rough sense, I can say that the distance have shrunk because the induced metric on that new surface, in some sense, is going to be smaller than the previous metric. That's why the distances are shorter. If we compare the situation here, I draw my geodesics for the convex surface. And, I didn't do a very good job here. Here we have a very different situation because those geodesics are diverging away from another. So if I repeat that construction here a little bit above the initial surface, what I'll notice here is that the distances have increased. And that's the precise meaning, you know, that distinguishes a concave surface from a convex surface. So here the distances have gone up, and that's, you know, because the metric, in some sense, has increased compared to what it used to be on the initial surface. So that's how we can, you know, assign mathematical meaning to this notion of bending. If it bends this way, distances go down. We measure this by a smaller metric versus here where the metric is larger. So the bending is really captured by the the normal derivative of the induced metric. And that's what the extrinsic curvature is meant to capture. The only thing that's missing now is, you know, something a bit more precise than this. So I'll just say that apart from a factor of two, this is, you know, what I mean by extrinsic curvature. It's the object that captures the normal derivative of the induced metric as we go a little bit above the surface. And then, you know, a concave surface versus a convex surface will differ by the sign of the extrinsic curvature, because, you know, in this case, we're dealing with a normal derivative that is negative. Here we're dealing with a normal derivative that's positive. So the sign of this will be transmitted to the sign of the extrinsic curvature. And that's what, mathematically speaking, describes the bending for us. So I hope the ideas are clear. After that, it's just, you know, basically finding increasingly more precise way of describing this mathematically, and we're going to be using our Gaussian coordinates, you know, to do that. So any questions at this point? Okay, very good. So let's keep going. So what do I mean by this? So this is not terribly well defined, because the induced metric that we're, so let's go back to thinking in terms of Gaussian coordinates. The induced metric is something that lives purely on the hypersurface. So it's defined only on the hypersurface. It's defined in terms of the, you know, more global metric here evaluated at L equals zero, namely on the hypersurface. So that thing here is not something that I can differentiate with respect to the normal direction, because it's defined only at that one place. So that definition doesn't quite, you know, make sense. But what would make sense is to start from the, you know, the extended metric here. That's something that I can, that, you know, that's something that does depend on L, and that's something that I can, you know, differentiate with respect to L. So my extrinsic curvature is going to be defined in terms of that one. So the more precise definition here is going to be that, well, the proper definition is going to be that the extrinsic curvature is going to be with a factor of 1/2 that is conventional here. It's going to be in terms, it's going to be defined by that extended metric in Gaussian coordinates differentiated with respect to L. And then after we're done differentiating, we're going to set L equals to zero. And that's going to give us, you know, a three tensor that's going to be defined purely on the hypersurface. So the derivative of the metric is defined, you know, away from the hypersurface. But when we evaluate that derivative at L equals zero, we get a quantity that's defined entirely on the hypersurface. And that's what I call the extrinsic curvature. And that is what, according to those ideas I just sketch here, that is what captures the bending of the surface in the underlying space. So here the ideas were sort of illustrated in the 2D goes to 3D context, but there's really no distinction, you know, there's really no problem in extending this to higher dimensions. And in fact, you can do, you know, n-dimensional manifolds embedded in n plus one dimensional manifolds. So the dimensionality really doesn't matter here. So I'm taking L to be positive going above the surface. So I'm introducing a sign convention when I do all of this that defines the direction of the normal vector. And I'm saying that L will increase in the same direction as the normal vector. So I have to pick an up direction and a down direction, and that is conventional. Yeah. Yep.
So the concept of extrinsic curvature is not necessarily coordinate dimension, but as we're seeing that one, so the other metric is taking the partial value of
that. Right. Right. So that is a very good question. So here I'm taking, you know, I'm defining, you know, explicitly in terms of Gaussian coordinates, and then we'll have to see whether we can come up with something better than this later on that would not be coordinate dependent, because yeah, we wouldn't want something so important to be subjected to one very specific coordinate system, and we'll see that there's a way of doing much better than this in a covariant sense. So that's good to point out. So this is defined in terms of Gaussian coordinates. So specifically, that's what I'm doing here. Okay, so that's the definition, and for the time being, we're gonna stick to that definition. And I want to keep exploring that a bit. I want to see how that might relate to Christoffel symbols that would live on a hypersurface, Riemann tensor that would live on a hypersurface, and things like that. So here is where I, you know, promise that I would be a bit more sketchy, and I'll just, you know, write down some results that I invite you to check for yourself if you're curious to, you know, to get a deeper education in this. All right, so let me define a few things. I've already done that to some extent. Let me go back to those notions here. So I'm going to talk about two types of Christoffel symbols, one that's defined purely in terms of the intrinsic geometry of the hypersurface, and the ones that would come from the underlying spacetime. So that's a distinction between three-dimensional Christoffel symbols defined in terms of the induced metric versus the original four-dimensional ones defined in terms of the four-dimensional spacetime metric. So when I write gamma ABC, I'm really thinking of this as the Christoffel symbols or the connection that's defined for us in terms of the induced metric. And that's a few, you know, a perfectly, you know, entirely 3D construction. And that's to be distinguished from a four-dimensional, a four-dimensional thing that I would, you know, put a four explicitly to indicate, that would be defined in terms of the underlying spacetime metric. So I want to distinguish the geometrical structures that we get purely on the hypersurface, the intrinsic ones, versus the ones that come from the underlying spacetime. And I'm gonna be looking to relate all of those things. All right, so that's the same idea. So when I talk about this Riemann tensor, I'm gonna think of this as, again, the one that comes entirely from the induced metric. Again, completely 3D versus a four-dimensional version of the Riemann tensor that would be coming from the space-time metric. So that is another thing that I would want to, you know, to relate in terms of the Gaussian coordinates. And then we have, you know, other things that we can define in terms of the induced metric that would want to be related to the four-dimensional version, and then we can keep going like this. And another thing I'll introduce, I think I introduced this notation, I will introduce the purely spatial or purely hypersurface defined covariant derivative that's going to be compatible with the induced metric versus the full, well, I don't need a four in this case, the full, you know, four-dimensional version that would be defined in terms of the full space-time tensor. All right, so basically what I want to do is to relate all of those things together. And that's a calculation that's, you know, very handy to do in Gaussian coordinates. What, you know, what we need to do if we want to figure out those relationships is to start from the, you know, original form of the metric. That's the metric for the entire space-time in Gaussian coordinates, and then we can calculate everything in sight using that metric. And then, you know, those calculations will involve operations that we perform on the spatial portion of the metric, or the hypersurface portion of the metric. And that, you know, because of this equality between the induced metric and the, you know, spatial portion of the metric evaluated at L equals zero, we're going to get naturally, coming out of this calculation, the purely geometric quantities that are associated with a hypersurface. So in words, I think it sounds more mysterious than it actually is. The purpose, you know, the strategy is simply start with the metric, calculate all the Christoffel symbols you can calculate from that metric, calculate the Riemann tensor from that metric, calculate the Ricci tensor from that metric, calculate the Einstein tensor from that metric, and see how it relates to geometrical quantities defined on the hypersurface. So it sounds like a long exercise, but in fact it's not that long because that metric is very simple. It's diagonal, at least between L and Y. The inverse is easy to calculate. So all those calculations are very easy, and I sketched some of those in the post-it notes, so you can find your way through that. So here's an example. So I'm talking about the non-vanishing Christoffel symbols. So those are the four-dimensional ones, but I'm calculating them in Gaussian coordinates. And if I want them to be non-vanishing, I can have a L here, and I can have two of the surface coordinates down here. That's going to be my notation. And when I calculate this, I'm going to get, according to that metric, I'm going to get something that I... So I'm going to get something that involves the normal derivative of the spatial metric. And if I evaluate this on the hypersurface, that's going to become the extrinsic curvature. So this is something that when we evaluate on sigma, so this is, you know, this is true a little bit above, a little bit below, but it's also true on the hypersurface. And when I evaluate this on the hypersurface, this becomes the extrinsic curvature. So it becomes minus epsilon KAB. So those Christoffel symbols in Gaussian coordinates are directly related to the extrinsic curvature. So that's one result that we get. And then if I calculate other components, I'll get a bunch that are going to be zero, but I'll get those that are not zero. So ALB. And this one, well, I'll just cut to the chase. That's given to us by KAB with one index up, the other index down. And by definition, this is just the inverse three metric acting on the extrinsic curvature with all the indices down. So that's already evaluated on the hypersurface. And then all the other ones are either going to be zero, or there are going to be those ones here where all the indices belong to the spatial coordinates, and that turns out to be the same as the three-dimensional ones. So basically the Christoffel symbols split into two groups, a group that corresponds purely to intrinsic information coming from the induced metric, and the other group where we have something coming out from the extrinsic curvature. And that gives us the complete set of Christoffel symbols. All the other ones, you know, the ones that might have two occurrences of L or three occurrences of L, those all vanish. The only ones that don't vanish are those. So that's what comes out. And I'm going to ask you to check this for yourself. It's an easy calculation. And I think you'll learn something if you actually bother to do it. We can do it for the Christoffel symbols. From the Christoffel symbols, we can go one step ahead and calculate the Riemann tensor, the full Riemann tensor for the four-dimensional spacetime expressed in Gaussian coordinates. And I'll show you the non-vanishing ones. So the non-vanishing components of the Riemann tensor well, here they are. So I'll put all my indices down. So I have the option of having two L's and an A and a B. And this is going to be given by, and that's pretty interesting, that's going to give us, given to us by two derivatives of that extended metric. So that's something that requires yet more structure, something that would require something that would be like the derivative of the extrinsic curvature. I would have to define something like this to relate it to that component of the Riemann tensor. And what we're going to do is to basically find a way to avoid doing this. And we're going to see that for many of the things we're interested in today's lecture, we can get everything we need simply from the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature. And that extra derivative here magically drops out of many things, many calculations we might wish to do, so that we don't need that extra structure in our, you know, in our set of quantities. So there's something pretty remarkable that will happen whenever we ask, you know, a meaningful question about, you know, the behavior of the hypersurface. We're going to find that those extra derivatives don't matter that much. What matters most, and a lot more than the second derivatives, are going to be the information contained in the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature. So that's the first term, and then there's a second term that we would get that would be quadratic in the extrinsic curvature. So remember, the Riemann tensor has derivatives of Christoffel's, that's where this is coming from, and it has terms quadratic in Christoffel's, this is where this is coming from. All right, so that's one component of the Riemann tensor. I have one where I have one occurrence of L, and then everything else is a spatial index. And that is pretty interesting. That corresponds to derivatives of the extrinsic curvature, but only spatial derivatives, intrinsic derivatives, sorry, AC. You know, derivatives of the extrinsic curvature defined purely on the hypersurface. Here we had to go, you know, in the normal direction. Here we're staying purely in the tangential directions of the hypersurface. We can get this component of the Riemann tensor by, you know, just differentiating the extrinsic curvature without having to know how it's supposed to behave away from the hypersurface. This is purely, those are purely intrinsic operations on the extrinsic curvature. If we know the extrinsic curvature on the hypersurface only, which we do, and we don't know any more than that, which we don't, we can calculate those derivatives because those derivatives are purely in the tangential directions defined on the hypersurface only. And for the purely spatial components of the Riemann tensor, we're going to get, first of all, the purely three-dimensional Riemann tensor coming out. That's going to be the first term. And then we're going to have terms quadratic in the extrinsic curvature. So apart from that one that requires more information, everything else about the Riemann tensor, the full four-dimensional Riemann tensor, can be calculated based purely on knowledge based on the induced metric HAB and the extrinsic curvature KAB. We don't need any more than that. And that's pretty remarkable because, you know, we have more stuff here and here than we have stuff there. Okay, so those are the non-vanishing Riemann components. And of course, we can always get more of them by, you know, using all the symmetries and all of that. So I'm just showing you the smallest, you know, non-vanishing group here. Okay, so we're going to see what we're going to do with all of this. I'm going to show you more stuff before I get to that. And what I'm going to do next is to imagine taking the Riemann tensor, calculating the Ricci scalar, then the Ricci tensor, then the Ricci scalar, then the Einstein tensor, and I'm going to show you the results for the Einstein tensor. And of course, you know, there are reasons why we might be interested in the Einstein tensor, so we'll get to that. All right, so let me imagine that we boil it down to the Einstein tensor, and now I'm going to show you the non-vanishing Einstein components. And first there's going to be one where, so that's the four-dimensional Einstein tensor in the normal direction. And that's given purely in terms of stuff defined on the hypersurface only. So here's the expression. we get the three-dimensional Ricci scalar, the one that we get from the induced metric. And then we get a couple of terms that are quadratic in the extrinsic curvature. And so I've already explained how I raise my indices. K is just a trace of the extrinsic curvature, and a trace is defined in terms of the inverse induced metric. So basically, that component of the Einstein tensor is something that I can calculate without reference to that one, to that, you know, second derivative. And then I have the normal tangential components, 1L, 1A, and that's also something that I can get purely from the extrinsic curvature without, again, requiring that second derivative term that we had before. So this is given by the covariant derivative of the extrinsic curvature in this combination. And finally, well, now I have my purely spatial components. And I won't write this down because, you know, there are lots of terms. So it's pretty complicated, but, you know, the key property here is that this is something that would, would involve the second derivative of the metric. So that's not something that I can express purely in terms related to extrinsic curvature and an induced metric. That would require that extra second derivative quantity that appears here. So I'll just say that this is complicated, and that this is something that involves that second derivative quantity that, of course, is going to be present in the Riemann tensor, so it's got to come down at some point. The remarkable thing is that it comes down in those components, but it's completely absent in those components of the Einstein tensor. And we're going to see the significance of that, you know, the next few minutes.
Actually, yeah, that's counterintuitive.
It's a bit what, sorry?
Because
if it shows up here, you would have expected maybe it shows up here?
Yeah, well, I mean, our GAB would be actually completely expressible in terms of the intrinsic one.
So I agree that it's not obvious that it turns out this way, and it really has to do with what happens when we go from Riemann to Einstein. You know, there are lots of contractions that need to be made, so, you know, the normal components will mix with the tangential components through those trace terms that we take, and in the end it just comes out. And it does come out that, well, that's the complicated one, and those two are, you know, simpler and also more important, involves only HAB and KAB, so they can be constructed purely in those terms without involving that extra structure. That, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that for the purposes of capturing, you know, what's happening close to a hypersurface, it's good to keep the number of geometric structures as limited as possible, and the notion that emerges is that if we know HAB and if we know KAB, we know a lot about how the surface is embedded, and we know a lot about relationships between four-dimensional and three-dimensional Riemann tensors, and in particular, Einstein tensors. And we're going to see that, you know, that's something that we can use as a way of building up. Sorry?
Can I have a question?
Sure. Yep.
Which one of these tensors are supposed to play the role of constraint? Which one? Dynamic.
Yeah, so I'll talk about the constraints in a few minutes, so just bear with me for a little while.
Okay.
Yeah, you have another question?
We can say that K is a measure of how much that's not going
to. Yeah, that's what I was telling you before. Yeah.
Not K, I mean just K.
Well, yeah, so K is a sort of, you know, distilled version of the information. You know, so the full tensor, the full extrinsic curvature gives us all the information about the bending. But if you want to distill it to a scalar quantity, well, that's what it takes. But it doesn't give you all the information. So the bending could be such that, you know, it's concave in one direction but convex in other directions. So different directions might have different bending behaviors. All of that would be captured by the full KAB, but the K itself would be sort of an average of those different behaviors in different directions.
Oh, so a neighborhood could be both convex and concave.
Yeah, because it could bend like this in one direction, like a saddle, right? Bends like this in one direction and bends like this in another direction.
So that's K equals an average, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So the trace is just one small part of the full tensor. The full tensor has, you know, all the information, and that's just basically a subset of that, an average. Yep.
So people discuss the K equals zero case as the sort of maximal slicing.
Yep.
Gauge condition or whatever rotating presents really mean physically.
Okay, that's a very interesting interesting question. I'll try to say something about this, but remind me a little bit later. I want to do a few more things first, and then I'll come back to that. Yeah. Other questions before we move on? Okay, so bottom line here is that, okay, I start out with my Gaussian coordinates, and I want to work out everything that we can work out from that metric, including all the components of, you know, Christoffel symbols, Riemann tensor, and everything else. And what we find here is that we can relate these things to two very important geometrical quantities, the induced metric and everything we can construct from that, and the extrinsic curvature. And that doesn't capture everything. There's still some stuff that, you know, that comes out that depends on the second derivative of the extended metric. But what we're going to see in the next few minutes is that, well, because those components don't care about that, and because those components don't care about that, there's a lot that we can do in terms of differential geometry of surfaces that cares only about H and K and doesn't care at all about that extra piece of it. That's not to say that we cannot, you know, we can do everything. Of course, we can't, because ultimately we would have to, you know, incorporate this in the description. What I'm saying is that we can do an awful lot and very important things based purely on that information. And that's where we're going to go next, by pursuing those ideas. Okay. So at this stage, I hope that you get the sense that the extrinsic curvature is an important quantity, and it tells us, for example, about the relationship between, the curvature in the underlying spacetime versus the curvature on purely defined on the hypersurface. So in a sense, the full curvature is the intrinsic curvature plus something involving the extrinsic curvature. So the words, you know, add up properly. So it's either, you know, in a quadratic combination like this or in a derivative combination like this. But I think here we get the sense that, you know, extrinsic curvature is a rather important quantity. And here we might be sort of concerned about the fact, like you raised before, that all of this was defined in terms of Gaussian coordinates. So if we're going to treat this in the manner that it deserves and, you know, consider that to be a, you know, very important object associated with hypersurfaces, we probably ought to rethink the definition and maybe make it generally covariant, so that when it's time to calculate something, you don't have to construct normal coordinates. You can just proceed with your favorite coordinate system and get the same answer regardless of the choice of coordinate system. It wouldn't be a very important object if it could only be defined like this in terms of special coordinates. So that's where we're going to go next. I'm going to try to put all of this into a covariant basis. Okay. Now I'm not going to forsake my Gaussian coordinates, because they're still very useful in performing all sorts of calculations, but I want to, you know, buy myself the freedom of not having to deal with them if I don't want to. So let's go back to the Gaussian coordinates, and let's remind ourselves of a couple of things that come with them. So we have the metric in Gaussian coordinates, but we also have a whole bunch of vectors. We have the normal vector to the hypersurface. We have all the tangential vectors to the hypersurface. So let's remind ourselves of those things, because I'm going to be using them in just a moment. So the normal vector to the hypersurface in terms of Gaussian coordinates, well, that's very simple. It points purely in the direction of L. So if I'm describing my coordinates in the order LYA, so, you know, the time direction versus the spatial directions, then my normal vector is guaranteed to point in the direction of L only, because that's the normal direction, and it will have zero, well, let me be more explicit, zero spatial components. So the normal vector can be expressed like this in Gaussian coordinates. I can look at the lowered version of this, which means that I can lower the lower the index with the metric given here, and we still get something purely in the normal direction, but now I have this factor of epsilon that goes with it. So the lowered components are going to be epsilon 0, 0, 0. And again, I'm using the orthogonality between the L part of the metric and the intrinsic part of the metric. And then I have a whole bunch of, you know, tangent vectors that are going to be basically in the direction of the YA coordinate lines. And those will have either 0 or 1 as components, depending on, you know, which tangent vector I'm talking about in relation to which y equal constant line that I'm talking about. So it's going to be just a bunch of 0 and 1s. So, you know, as an example, E alpha 1 is going to be in Gaussian coordinates 0, 1, 0, 0. And, you know, all the other ones can be written in a very similar ways. Okay, so that's what I also have when I'm dealing with Gaussian coordinates. And I want to return to this question here, how to provide a covariant definition of extrinsic curvature. While I'm going to tell you what it is, we're going to recognize that it's a perfectly fine covariant definition of something. And then I'm going to apply the definition to Gaussian coordinates, and we're going to verify that it reduces to exactly the same thing we had before. And we're going to have at that stage a statement that this tensor is equal to that tensor in one coordinate system. And if that's true, then they have to be the same in all coordinate systems. So let me go through that, step by step. So here's my claim. My claim is that the extrinsic curvature can be defined in the following way. I can define it in terms of a covariant derivative of the normal vector projected onto all the tangential directions. All right. So what kind of an, so that's my claim, and I'm going to justify the claim in just a few seconds, and it's going to be an easy calculation to verify that this KB is the same thing that we were talking about all along. So what kind of an object is this? So it's always interesting to ask that question when we're dealing with, you know, hypersurface objects, because they often have different identities regarding their space-time identity versus their purely spatial or purely hypersurface identities. So in a 4D point of view, I look at my space-time indices here, and I see that they're being summed over in both cases. So as far as the four-dimensional space-time is concerned, that's just a whole bunch of scalars. So these are scalars as far as their properties under coordinate transformations are concerned in the full four-dimensional space-time. There's no surviving space-time index. They're all being summed over, and according to the 4D way of thinking about it, we're dealing with scalars. So we just have a whole bunch of them, because we can pick any index we want here for KAB in the three-dimensional space where it lives. If we look at it from the hypersurface point of view, well, this is a covector. This is a covector. And we're mixing those two covectors together, and we define what is a proper three-dimensional tensor on that hypersurface. So the same object viewed differently has different tensorial identities. Either it's a bunch of scalars, or it's an actual tensor, two-index tensor, in that, you know, in that space. So the point is that, you know, the tensorial identity of an object depends on the tensorial space in which it's defined, and we have different tensorial spaces depending on whether we looked at this from a 4D point of view or a 3D point of view. Okay. So my point is that, okay, so if we look at this from the four-dimensional point of view, we're dealing with a scalar, and a scalar has the property that, you know, it doesn't matter in which coordinate system you define it, it's going to be the same regardless of the identity of the coordinate system. So that's going to be the same in all coordinate systems. And by that, I mean four-dimensional coordinate systems. So if it's true that those scalars are equal to what I claimed them to be in Gaussian coordinates, if we have equality in Gaussian coordinates, we're guaranteed to have equality in all coordinate systems. That's a property of scalars. If they're equal to some value in one coordinate system, a scalar being a scalar means that it's going to be exactly the same if you calculate it, evaluate it in a very different coordinate system. So what I'm going to do is to rely on that property. What I'm saying is that if we find that the right-hand side is equal to the right thing in Gaussian coordinates, then we have proved that this definition applies, you know, gives us exactly what we want, but now we have a means to do the calculation in a very different coordinate system. So I hope you get the idea here behind the strategy. It's always back to the same theme that, you know, introduce a coordinate system that allows you to do the calculation the most, you know, easy way possible. And then once you calculate a scalar or a tensor in those coordinate systems, once you establish the equality between, you know, scalars or tensors in that coordinate system, then the coordinates can be discarded. You have established equality in all coordinate systems. That's the beauty of having tensors in your formulations of the laws of physics. So it's always, to me, a good idea to pick the coordinate system that allows you to do something the best way possible with minimum effort. And then, you know, when they serve their purposes, you can get rid of them. Maybe, you know, come back to them sometime later. But the point is that they serve their purposes. And then, you know, after that, you can proceed with covariant definitions if it's more convenient. Okay, so let's do the calculation in Gaussian coordinates. So let's just do this, but now I'm gonna use all of those results, you know, that we get in Gaussian coordinates and take advantage of them. So so I'm gonna start with the same place. But now, of course, those tangent vectors now are going to be just a bunch of deltas. So that will amount to taking the spatial covariant derivative of the spatial components of the normal vector. And of course, you're going to tell me that there are no spatial components of the normal vector. And that's true. But before I incorporate that information, I'll just write this in terms of partial derivatives and a Christoffel symbol term, where we're going to have a summation index alpha and the two indices here, they come down over here, and here I have an alpha. So the point is that when we do this calculation, we have to remember that we're summing over all possible values for the spacetime index, and that will introduce an L term right here. All right, so the spatial components are zero, so when you differentiate them, they don't give us anything. And the normal component, the L component of the normal vector, is going to give us an epsilon. So still working out the calculation in Gaussian coordinates, what we get is that this whole sum here reduces to a single term, and we get a factor of epsilon coming from n. And then the only thing that survives are going to be the L component of the LAB component of the Christoffel symbols. And well, fortunately, that's something we computed before. There it is over there on the board. When we evaluate this on the hypersurface, we get minus epsilon KAB. So what do we get? Still working in Gaussian coordinates, we get minus epsilon. That multiplies minus epsilon KAB. That's the KAB that we define in Gaussian coordinates. Epsilon goes to 1, because epsilon is plus or minus 1. The minus signs go away. And that tells us that in Gaussian coordinates, the scalar KAB is equal to the covariant version of that scalar KAB. We have established the equality of scalars in one coordinate system. Therefore, we have equality in all coordinate systems. So, equality between the, you know, Gaussian coordinate defined KAB and the covariantly defined KAB, we have established equality in Gaussian coordinates. So equality in Gaussian coordinates, but we are dealing with scalars, and therefore we have equality in all coordinates. So that the extrinsic curvature can be defined in a very nice covariant way from the space-time point of view, like that. So that's how we calculate these things. So we don't go back to Gaussian coordinates. As I said, typically if you wanted to introduce Gaussian coordinates in any given space-time, that might be, you know, difficult. Whereas applying this definition, when you know the identity of the tangent vectors and the identity of the normal vector, well, that's, you know, a very quick calculation. And by now you're all experts at doing these things on Maple or Mathematica. So this is no more challenging than anything else that you've computed before. So we're going to see examples of that. In a few minutes. Okay, so that is my covariant definition of extrinsic curvature. So one thing that's interesting that gets lost in that translation from Gaussian to covariant is the fact that, well, it was pretty obvious from the get-go that my extrinsic curvature was symmetric, just like the metric is symmetric. So that was obvious from the definition in Gaussian coordinates, but when you stare at that expression over here, it's no longer obvious that the tensor is symmetric. But that's okay, you can prove that it's symmetric, because if you consider the symmetrized version of this, or the, you know, the flipped version of this, you go through exactly the same calculation, you're going to get exactly the same outcome, because in the end, you know, you're going to be ending up here, and the Christoffel symbols are symmetric. So it's not obvious from the definition, but it's it's true regardless that that as viewed from, you know, a three-dimensional point of view, we're dealing here with a symmetric three tensor. So both the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature is symmetric. So I should point this out. We have a tensor that is actually symmetric under an exchange of A and B. There's a nice way of writing this out in terms of a symmetrized expression that gives you a relationship with the Lie derivative of the metric in the normal direction. I'm not going to dwell on this here, but it's a nice connection that you can make. So the extrinsic curvature can be expressed as the Lie derivative of the full spacetime metric in the normal direction projected down onto the tangential directions. So you can, you know, find that connection in the post-it notes or in the book, but I don't think I need to dwell on that.
That connection suggests that in Gaussian coordinates, when we take a partial derivative with respect to L, that's the same as a lead derivative with respect to N.
Yeah. It pretty much, yeah, it amounts to that. That's right. Yeah. So those partial derivatives, because the normal direction is in the direction of that coordinate, so you can always relate a coordinate derivative to a Lie derivative with a vector that points in that coordinate direction. So that's exactly what we see here. So the only thing that's missing is, you know, then that projection onto the spatial indices. So that's the only thing. Okay, so that's my covariant definition. I can also come up with covariant versions of some of those results over here. So I can re-express those important relations that we worked out before regarding some components of the Riemann tensor and re-express them also in covariant terms just by making use of the normal vector and the tangential vectors that we have here. So again, to obtain those results, we don't need to use Gaussian coordinates every time. We can just re-express that in covariant terms, and that's something that we can then do in all coordinate systems. So again, sounds more complicated when I say it in words. So let me just tell you what I meant by all of this. I don't want to erase all of this. So the equations that I'm about to write down are called Gauss-Kodaczy equations. And they're just covariant versions of what we already have there on the board. So if I look at this component of the Riemann tensor, well, it's pretty clear that this L index here that is relevant in Gaussian coordinates is really telling me to take the Riemann tensor and project it in the normal direction, because the normal direction is the L direction. And those indices here are just telling me to take projections in the tangential directions. So in Gaussian coordinates, there's no distinction between that first component of the Riemann tensor here and something that I might express as this, because, you know, the n direction points purely in the L direction, and all of those tangential vectors point in their corresponding coordinate directions. So that thing here is exactly what I expressed here. But I guess that wasn't for me. But now I have it in fully covariant terms because, you know, I've taken all of my special indices and converted them into tensor indices and compensated for that by taking appropriate corrections. But this operation I can do in any coordinate system. I don't have to use Gaussian coordinates. So bottom line is that this covariant combination of the Riemann tensor I can express as covariant derivatives of the extrinsic curvature. And those ones down there, the purely spatial ones, well, this will correspond to a projection entirely in the tangential direction for all the indices. And that's something I can express as the three-dimensional Riemann tensor minus the quadratic terms, KA, CKBD. Minus K A D K B C. Now, perfectly covariant expressions, and then I can do something similar for the components of the Einstein tensor. So the first one is the one that I get when I project for both indices in the normal direction. So those are the normal component to the Einstein tensor. And that's given by 1/2 epsilon r plus kab kab minus k squared. And then finally, we have the normal tangential component. How do I write it? Yeah. N mu e alpha a. And that's given by derivatives of the extrinsic curvature minus dak. So the point is that, unlike the version I had before, this way of writing the equations, those are covariant with respect to a change in space-time coordinates, because all my quantities on the left-hand side, after all those projections, define a collection of scalars. And what I have on the right-hand side, according to the space-time point of view, those things are all a bunch of scalars. So this is covariant with respect to x alpha, and therefore those are equations that I can, you know, play with, or even, you know, and you know, I can play with those equations in any coordinate system that I want. So Gaussian coordinates are great because they allowed us to do all of this in the simplest possible way. But in the end, we, you know, get rid of them. That was the sort of scaffolding that we needed to establish our results. After that, we just get rid of the scaffolding, and what remains is that, you know, very nice cathedral that we get in those equations, and equations that have, you know, very important applications, and that's what we'll turn to next. Okay, so any questions at this stage? All good? Okay, so I think I'll finish off the lecture this morning by just you know, pretending to work through a number of examples. And by pretending to work through, what I mean is that I'll show you the examples, I'll write down the answers, and I'll challenge you to find those answers on your own. So those are not difficult calculations, but, you know, I don't want to spend the time working through the calculation here. I think it's more instructive if you actually do it. And perhaps some of you will actually accept the challenge. So let's just look through a succession of examples, and I think we'll be able to get some intuition about the meaning of extrinsic curvature as we do that. Okay, so let's do that. So we've looked at this to some extent already. So here's our 2D sphere in a flat three-dimensional space. And so in 3D space, we're going to have Cartesian coordinates. Let me call them alpha, x, y, and z. And to describe the sphere, we're going to put down some angular coordinates. So in the 2D space, we're going to have theta and phi as angular coordinates. And we've talked about how to calculate the normal vector. We've talked about how to calculate the tangential vectors by invoking the embedding relations. So the embedding relations, that's simply the relationship between the Cartesian coordinates and the angular coordinates. So it's basically just r sine theta cosine phi for x, r sine theta sine phi for y and r cosine theta for z. And then the normal vector, well, that's going to be given by, well, the equation that gives me the hypersurface, so x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals a constant, so it amounts to cosine theta sine phi, sine theta cosine phi sine theta sine phi cosine theta. So that's the normal vector. And then the tangential vectors are just given by the partial derivatives of the 3D coordinates with respect to the 2D coordinates. And then, you know, we did all of this before. We calculated the induced metric from all of this. The induced metric is simply the scalar product between all the tangential vectors. And for the sphere, we got r squared 0, 0, r squared sine squared theta. So that's the familiar metric for a two-dimensional sphere. So the intrinsic coordinates here are two-dimensional. And then, you know, to calculate the extrinsic curvature, all we would have to do is to mix all of those things together and do this computation using our set of tangential vectors and our normal vector. So just straightforwardly evaluate all of this, and that's where I'm going to skip the calculation, and I'm just going to tell you that this amounts to this. And another way of expressing this is to say that the extrinsic curvature is actually 1 over r times the induced metric. So the spherical symmetry of the situation here pretty much guaranteed that any two tensor can be related to the fundamental two tensor, namely the induced metric. And you know, that's the relationship that we get here. And you know, if we wanted to calculate the trace of this, we would get that the trace of the extrinsic curvature is 2 over r. And the fact that it's positive tells us that the distances are increasing as we go away from the surface, something that you can well imagine because all of those radial directions expand out. And that's translated by the fact that the extrinsic curvature is basically a positive definite tensor. It has two positive eigenvalues, if you want to think of it like that. All right, so that's a very simple exercise, and I'll ask you to check this. And just learn how to do those computations. It's very educational. So that was the first example. Let's do a few more. I'm going to do another one going from 2D to 3D to 2D. So example two, we're going to look at the cylinder. And the cylinder is kind of interesting. So let's draw the cylinder. And I'm going to take the x, the z-axis here to be right in the middle, x, y, and z. It's going to be a radius. Cylinder of radius r. And again, for the 3D coordinate system, I'm going to use Cartesian coordinates. And for the 2D system, intrinsic to the cylinder, I'm going to use the angle phi that goes around the cylinder, and I might as well use z that goes up and down on the cylinder. So I'm going to use z and phi as intrinsic coordinates. So to calculate anything, I need embedding relations. And that's just a relationship between all of those coordinates. And those are going to be basically the relationship between x and phi. And for radius r, it's going to be r cosine phi. Y is going to be r sine phi. And z is going to be z.
Can you make x, y, z?
Oh, yes, thank you. That would be a strange coordinate system otherwise. Thank you for that. All right, so those are the embedding relations. From the embedding relations, I can get the tangential vectors. The normal vector, while I could get from the fact that the description of the cylinder is the fact that x squared plus y squared is equal to a constant, and that will give me a normal vector that will be equal to cosine phi, sine phi, and zero. So it points in, you know, it points away from the axis. And if I calculate the induced metric for this, I have to look it up. The induced metric will be two-dimensional, and I'm writing it in this ordering here, z and phi. So it's going to be a 1, where am I? Yeah, a 1 along z, 0, 0, and it's going to be an r squared along phi. So what I mean by this is that if I write the line element restricted to the surface of the cylinder, it's going to be dz squared plus r squared d phi squared. And this is actually a flat metric. This is flat. Mathematically, you can recognize this by saying that I can absorb r into a redefinition of phi, and I get something that looks like dz squared plus d something else squared, and that's identical to a 2D Euclidean metric. That's the mathematical recognition. The physical recognition is simply that you can take your cylinder and cut it, and and undo the roll, and it's going to lie flat on a table. So the intrinsic geometry of a cylinder is completely flat. The reason why it looks not flat to us is because it's embedded in 3D, and what we see here is the bending. And that is captured not by the metric, it's captured by the extrinsic curvature. So that's why the cylinder is a bit more interesting as an example compared with the sphere. So if I calculate the extrinsic curvature, what we're going to find is that there's only one non-zero entry. It's so the eigenvalues are 0 and r. And it's because there's bending when we look at that direction, the radial direction, but there's no bending when we look up. The z direction is completely flat, and that's captured by the fact that this component of the extrinsic curvature is zero. So there's no bending in one direction, some bending, positive bending, in the opposite direction, in the orthogonal direction. So here, the trace of the extrinsic curvature is just 1 over r, not 2 over r, because in this case, we only have one non-zero eigenvalue. So, interesting little example. So we're still in 2D going to 4D. And let me do one more, and then we'll quit for lunch, and then I'll do some more after lunch. So let's do t equal constant, slice of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And, well, I could tell you what the answer is without doing anything. The answer is zero. So let's think through that. So here's the metric. So four-dimensional space-time this time around. And I don't really need to write down what f is. That would be true for any spherically symmetric space-time like this. In fact, it doesn't matter. I could generalize this even more. And what I want to consider is just a space-like hypersurface that corresponds to the condition that t is equal to a constant. And then, I can use r theta phi as perfectly fine coordinates on that space-like hypersurface. And if I do that, well, all that's going to happen when I define the induced metric from the space-time metric is that I'm going to lose this direction. So this over here will give me the induced metric. So the induced metric is simply going to be the spatial part of the Schwarzschild metric. So it's going to be f minus 1, 0, 0, 0, r squared, 0, 0, r squared sine squared theta. All right. So here my space-time coordinates are t theta phi, sorry, tr theta phi. My intrinsic coordinates, well, we could choose a different set, but why? That would be the simplest choice. So we can define the normal vector, we can define all the tangential vectors, we can do all of those things. The embedding relations, well, couldn't be simpler. T is equal to T, R is equal to R, theta is equal to theta, phi is equal to phi. Those are the embedding relations. The normal vector is going to be purely along T. All the tangential vectors are going to be purely along R or theta or phi. So, you know, very, very simple. And then you calculate this and you get zero. Why? Why is it zero? Yep.
Can I repeat that so I know the percent of time requirement? So if you express the Riemann tensor as transit curvatures, can I think about that as the Riemann tensor being the opposite of the Ricci and the wild part? That's related to the Ricci and influence. I'm not sure if that's
May not be wrong, but that's not the most, you know, the most immediate why.
Because it does not evolve in time.
Sorry, say again?
Because it does not evolve in time.
Right.
Oh.
Right. So remember, so the extrinsic curvature captures the change in spatial distances as we go up from the hypersurface. As we go up from this hypersurface, we get another T equal constant hypersurface, and all the distance relations are exactly the same as they were. We're dealing with a static spacetime. So if you have that intuition, then you don't even need to do a calculation. You know that this is a situation because of the static nature of the spacetime, where literally nothing changes as we go up the hypersurface, and that translates into a vanishing extrinsic curvature. So this is true because we're dealing with a static spacetime. Now, the next example that we're going to do after lunch is going to be dealing with the same static spacetime, but I'm going to introduce a slicing that is not the same. And that will translate into a non-zero extrinsic curvature. So the static nature here is exploited because we're dealing with a t equal constant slice of the Schwarzschild spacetime, and it's in terms of that t that the spacetime is, doesn't change. If I were to take any other slicing and changed it in, you know, a different way, then just because we have a static spacetime doesn't guarantee that the extrinsic curvature will vanish, and we're going to see an example of that. So, but here I think we could have guessed it all along just based on that intuition. Nothing changes if we go away from that hypersurface. Okay, so any questions before we stop? Okay, that's good. So let's pick this up again in the afternoon. And Connor, I will get back to your question in the afternoon, provided you remind me, because I might forget.